Welcome to the Behind the Shield podcast. My name is James Gearing and this is episode 172. And I'm very, very excited to bring to you a man who I used to listen to before I started this podcast and was certainly one of the few podcasts that inspired me to pull the trigger on this. And that is California law enforcement officer Garrett Teslar. Now, Garrett started his podcast kind of on a dual role, one to document his own roots back to good health, and secondly, to identify the challenges that they see in the first responder profession. So it was very cool to pick his brains. We've shared some of the same guests, some of whom I heard first on his podcast, and get a kind of police versus fire EMS perspective of the wellness challenges, many of which are exactly the same. So we talk about that. We talk about the perception of the police officers in the media. I mean, a fantastic response to that. We talk about mass shootings and responses, national emergencies, just a whole array of topics. So you're really going to enjoy this. As I always say, before we start the episode, please go to your podcast app, rate the show, share the show, obviously subscribe. And then most importantly, use social media, help this project grow and share these episodes. These men and women take the time to talk to us. And my goal is to get it to every single ear hole that needs to hear it around this entire globe. So with that being said, I introduce to you Garrett Teslar. Enjoy. All right. Well, Garrett, I want to say firstly, thank you so much for agreeing to come on. And one of the reasons why I really wanted to reach out to you is I credit starting the podcast myself to a few projects, Joe Rogan, Tim Ferriss, Barbell Shrugged, and you're the fourth one, The Squad Room. And before I started this, I was listening to you and your guests, and I'm looking around in my, you know, fire EMS side looking for the same kind of thing and didn't find it at all. So that's kind of what spurred me to start, you know, on the fire side. But so initially, I just want to say thank you for your project and thank you for agreeing to come on today.
Excited to be here, man. I don't know if I deserve to be mentioned in the same sentence as those other individuals and shows, so you're making me blush, but I appreciate that a lot.
No, but it's true. I mean, all of us are just men with microphones, you know, or women, so there's no hierarchy in the podcast world, in my opinion.
No, that's a great point.
So, all right, well, I'd love to start at the very beginning then. So firstly, where are we finding you right now?
There's a lot of ways to answer that question. You mean the where am I physically or mentally or emotionally? Or
all right, let's be more specific. Geographically, where are you at the moment?
I am sitting at my house in Santa Barbara, California.
Santa Barbara, beautiful. It's gorgeous up there.
I pay to live here through the taxes and everything, but man, I can't think of a better place to live.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. I actually did you have Eric Goodman on the show? You did, didn't you? From Foundation Training?
Yeah. In fact, I ran into him at the grocery store last week.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say, because he's doing the certification up there at the moment. He lives in Hawaii now, but he's there training at the moment. So
yeah, he used to live here in Santa Barbara, and that's how I got to know him through mutual friends. And he was like guest 10 on my show. He was the first guest I think I had who was a local, yeah.
Yeah. He's amazing. I'll give you a super long story short. I hurt my back, used Foundation to train to heal it, was so amazed, got my department to send me to go be an instructor. So I actually went over there 3 years ago, almost exactly, to get certified and come back and teach my department Foundation Training because I was so impressed.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want this episode to be about back pain, we can end it now and just say go do Foundation Training because I had the same experience with it.
Brilliant. We'll talk that more about that in a minute then. So you live in Santa Barbara. Where were you born?
I was born in Illinois, actually.
Okay. So if you wouldn't mind, what just kind of the family unit, what did your parents do and how many siblings did you have?
I have a sister, and my parents came out of music. And both were music teachers up until around the time I was born. My dad was in school getting his PhD in music. And then music was a consistent thing through my life, but that wasn't what they were doing as I grew older. As I grew older, they were, they developed into different careers. And, but I grew up most of my life. I grew up in Colorado.
Okay. Now, did you play any instrument yourself? Were they influenced on you?
I always say that I'm a recovering musician because I was never great. I played a little bit of piano. I played violin, trumpet, all those things you play like in the band in high school or in junior high or elementary. In high school, I started playing guitar and was convinced I was going to be the Edge, U2 being one of my favorite bands. So I came home one day and told my dad that I wasn't going to college because I was going to go on tour with my new band. I think we were sophomores in high school. He wasn't a big fan of that idea. He comes out of the classical music world. So like rock and roll or rock music or anything like that to him is just, you know, nails on a chalkboard. But I actually sang growing up, which is a little known fact about me. You're already teasing something out. But yeah, I guess you could say it was kind of a semi-professional singer in the sense that I would do bit parts in opera. I was in a touring group that would tour and do classical music. I was in some Broadway style productions of things. The most unique one of those, the things that people seem to laugh at the most, was I actually sang backup for John Denver once.
Oh, really? How did you just being booked for that gig or?
The group I was with, yeah. Yeah, so I got to sing in front of, I don't know, 20,000 people at that show, but did things like the opening ceremonies of the Alpine Ski Championships, you know, so broadcast into something like 30 million homes. Like, it was an interesting experience growing up.
Right. Now, was that at that point, was that a profession, like a full-time profession, or was this on the side?
This was totally, this wasn't, I say semi-professional because I wasn't even getting paid. It was just more about the experience of doing it. And I was only in up until about eighth grade that I was doing this, but it was traveling a lot, traveled internationally doing things and traveling to China as a United Nations Goodwill Ambassador through that program. So it was a great exposure and great experience, but it was short, early on where I realized I didn't have the discipline or the desire to actually sit and learn how to play the guitar. I just wanted to be a rock star. I wanted to jump right to that. And in that process, I started learning more about the business side of music and realized that the guys standing backstage seemed to have a much better life in general than the guys on stage, and started getting interested in the music business side of things. And that's actually where I ended up going out of college. I actually started interning at record labels and radio stations in high school. And my first career really was the music industry in New York City and Los Angeles before I ever considered going into public service.
Right. So then what was your journey through that? Was it a pleasurable career for those few years?
I mean, think about being 22, 23, 24 years old, living in Manhattan. You have a county, or not a county, a company expense account, right? A company credit card. I was in a department called Artist Relations, so for Atlantic Records. And at the time, Atlantic was just blowing up. They were huge. Kid Rock, when I worked there, Kid Rock was just gone about 1 million sold on the records, and he was about to go to 10 million sold. And this is, of course, back when people actually bought records. But so I'm in that age. I'm in Artist Relations, and my job, my only real job there is to keep the artists happy. And so I was kind of given free rein to interact with them in any way during awards shows or CD release parties, album release parties, when they would go on Letterman or they'd go on any of the late shows or the Today Show. I was there to just kind of, again, make sure that they were comfortable and happy and they got what they needed. So, you know, you can imagine as a 22, 23-year-old guy in New York City with an expense account and access to rock stars, there's some great stories that come out of that and a lot of fun, but also something that is exhausting if it's not really who you are at your core after a while.
Yeah. Now, are you able to recall any of the stories?
Well, yeah, it was just some of the random things that would happen. Like I remember one night I was just sitting at a nightclub with, and again, I'm like 22. And then MTV Video Music Awards had just happened. Like they were that night and we were at an after party. And actually I was working the door at the party afterwards, because that was kind of one of our jobs, was to help organize these parties after these award shows and make sure the guest list was correct and all that. And then I remember my boss was like tired and over it. And he's like, all right, take care of him. I'm out of here. And so I'm left in charge of entertaining Kid Rock, Mark McGrath from Sugar Ray, Sebastian Bach from Skid Row, a couple of the other band guys, and I'm drawing a blank on the other guy who was there. But it was just one of those really bizarre, surreal moments where you got all these guys who've, you know, Kid Rock's probably the biggest rock star in the world at this point in time, and they're standing around looking at me like, so what are we going to do? Longer story short, ended up having to break up fights between them and some bouncers, and it was a fun job while it lasted, but realized too that there was really not a lot to the job in terms of what I was getting out of it. I mean, I was getting a lot of fun out of it, I guess, and these entertaining stories, but the one I remember, the real moment, the first moment where I thought this isn't going to be what I do for the rest of my life, was sitting in a conference room having a discussion about that MTV Video Music Awards night that I just talked about. And we're going around the room, and I'm just a plebe in this room, right? I'm an assistant. So everyone else is talking. They're having this very serious conversation because Kid Rock's about to perform on the VMAs, and they're organizing the performance. And they're having this very serious discussion about what he can do on stage and what he can't do and what's appropriate and what's not. And they were talking about, the discussion centered around how many strippers was too many strippers to have on stage on a national TV show. And some people were adamantly arguing that 10 was perfectly fine, and others were arguing that 4 was fine or 6 was too much. And this was a heated debate because, you know, there's decency laws and such. And I thought, regardless of your opinions about strippers, I'm using my bandwidth in my brain to have this conversation or be part of this conversation, and I'm not advancing the world in any way here. It took a couple years after that. This is in like 1999. It took a couple years after that, and of course 9/11, to really shift me and push me towards finally stepping out of that.
Yeah, it sounds like Dr. Seuss should have written a book about how many strippers could be on stage.
Right.
That would have been very helpful. Yeah, no, I had a similar kind of thing myself where I was in stunts. So I was performing as a stuntman. And, you know, again, I was doing the stunts. I was one of the performers, but again, not like a star role. It was more in the background. But that environment was very self-serving. And I worked with some great, great people. But just the role itself requires everyone to look at you. And then I came to a point where, just probably like you're saying, where I was like, I don't want it to be about me. I want it to be about other people. And that was kind of what shifted in my mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's, you do that long enough for, you know, I always kind of joke, I deal with the same people just in a different capacity now, because there's a lot of, obviously the rock and roll lifestyle, a lot of that is very true. And staying away from it when you have no desire to be a part of that to begin with is hard. And I mean, some ways it's hard, in some ways it's easy. You make a decision and you just stick with it. But it's tiring, I guess, maybe is a better way to say it.
Yeah. So then what were some of the pivotal moments that drove you towards a life of service, and specifically the law enforcement community?
So as I mentioned, I was living in New York City, right? And then when I moved from Colorado to New York, I was like a New Yorker born in the wrong state. I loved New York. New York meant a lot to me when I lived there. I just absolutely fell in love with it and felt like I was immediately home the minute I moved there, right? And like I was putting on a well-cut suit for the first time, and it just fit. Everything fit about me living in New York City. And so I just left New York to move to L.A., with every expectation that I'd move back to New York City within a couple of years. But I took a job in LA, and it was right before 9/11. And I was fortunate that I didn't know anybody directly who was killed in those attacks. But a lot of my coworkers, my bosses, all grew up in New York City, and they knew people. And it was so there was like a 2 degrees of separation kind of thing from something that big. But it struck me watching that, you know, I, like everybody else who was kind of young, filled with anger and well, you know, frustration and all those things out of that event. And I was watching how like NYPD, their role in going after in the response, right? They were at least domestically, one of the people or one of the organizations that was responsible for not tolerating this, I guess. I don't want to say like vengeance because that's not what it was and that's not our role. But they, you know, they stood up to it and they stood up to it as best they could. And then in L.A. was here and I lived right on the jurisdiction line between LAPD and L.A. sheriffs and interacted with both those agencies and watched both those agencies and watched them do stuff that was just abnormal and was not like what normal humans are capable of, I thought, at least at the time, and was really I was interested in the sense of justice and the sense of you know, right and wrong. And I had plenty of opportunities to watch people in my neighborhood become victimized and be taken advantage of. And I was taken advantage of with, you know, break-ins and such. And the people who were always the ones who were there to defend us and stand up for us and then also try and seek some sort of justice were the cops. And so I'd always held a high level of respect for the job, but it never occurred to me that I could do it. And it was through just kind of watching those things and then learning about reserve programs that I started kind of investigating the job almost on a, like a hobby basis. You know, I went to a Citizens Academy just to learn more about it. I did ride-alongs, and it was this really slow process where one day I realized this is actually what I'm supposed to be doing.
Right. So from that point, what took you to, to the career and which department did you choose?
I won't say my department, just because that's an agreement I have with them when I do these things.
Absolutely.
My wife is from this area, and when I started applying, I was originally looking at reserve programs, like I mentioned, and in LA, they have a very robust reserve program where you can go through an academy, and just like anyone else, and then you can basically donate a couple hours to several hours or several shifts worth of work every month and keep your day job. And I thought, man, that's like Batman. I could be music industry hip guy during the day and once or twice a month go run patrol and work a car with a full-time deputy or officer. So that's originally what I pursued, was trying to be a reserve. And quickly learned that in both those agencies, but I think any agency, has a hard time with the idea that some guy who's interacting with rock stars all the time and movie actors, because by now I was working at a film studio, could be so, you know, for lack of a better term, squeaky clean. And so as I was going through those processes, though, I was kept doing ride-alongs and realized this is actually something I want to do full-time. Didn't necessarily want to work in that environment of LAPD or LASO as I raised a family. So, but I wasn't against it. Was looking at other agencies and applying around, and I got picked up by, it was basically who picked me up the fastest. and I lucked out that it was in, you know, a gorgeous part of the country.
Right. Now, at that point, what about your athletic and fitness side? Is that something that you pursued actively?
I have always had a love-hate relationship with athletics. Growing up, I made the basketball team in high school, but then was told I only made it because I had hustle and heart, but I was never going to play. So I quit the team because I was like, I'm not going to sit on the bench. I quit the baseball team in high school because I didn't like the coach. So like organized sports were never mine. I was at one point in my life convinced I was going to be a Tour de France level cyclist. So cycling was actually my sport growing up. There's an element of team sport to it that people often don't get, but also there's an individual element, and it fit well for me and my personality. A growth spurt my senior year in high school pretty much squashed that career as I grew like 6 inches and gained, you know, 60, 70 pounds and changed from like sprinter cyclist body to fullback or a tight end style. I've never been someone who's been completely committed to that consistent lifestyle and discipline in that way. And that's been, of course, the crux of my frustration with some of these things and basically why I started the whole podcast.
Yeah. And I want to explore that. So when you first went through the academy, was your level of fitness pretty good at that point as far as the demands of what you needed to achieve?
Yeah, I had, and before the academy, I'd gone through some, I did the Body for Life program on my own a couple of years before the academy and had success with that and was actually in decent shape, decent walking around shape at the time. But then I knew that for the academy, I was going to have to get into much better shape. And so I started obviously a pretty more more regimented approach to getting ready for the academy and actually ended up hurting myself running so much. I came into the academy with shin splints, which is not a good position to be in. But I didn't know any better. You know, I was told I need to be able to run about 3 to 4 miles a day, 5 days a week. And so I started doing that pretty quickly and I didn't work myself up to it. So one of my biggest challenges in the academy was dealing with those injuries so that I wouldn't wash out. But yeah, I came into the academy in okay shape, by far not, I was not a rock star by any means. And in fact, in the academy I went to, they called it the fitness squad, but we all called it the fat squad. And it was those of us who, either carried extra weight. I think they put one really skinny, scrawny guy in there just to make us feel better, who needed to gain muscle. The rest of us maybe needed to lose more weight. But, you know, and just in general, I am not a small frame. I'm about, you know, a little under 6'3". And like I say, built more like a tight end than anything. So maintaining that has always been a challenge.
Yeah, because one thing I've made an observation of in several of the previous episodes is when you look at an academy class of, you know, law enforcement officers and firefighters, you know, like you said, there's going to be different frames. But all in all, you've got a group of fired up men and women that are in pretty damn good shape. And then my argument then with some of the conditions surrounding the shifts and you know, sleep deprivation and the effect that has on the body is that you fast forward, say, 10 years, and now those same guys that you graduated with, a lot of them are, you know, a ghost of who they used to be physically and mentally.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I was that ghost, you know, and you stop one day and you're like, how did I get here? You know, and what are the issues that I have to deal with? And how, for me, there was a huge struggle trying to figure out how to maintain fitness with the shift work. And, you know, just they're all excuses in different ways, I suppose. But it was very real to me that I couldn't, you know, it was frustrating too, because there were people, my academy classmate being one of them, who, like, to this day doesn't look much different than the day he entered the academy. But you know, there's always mitigating factors or exacerbating factors to these kinds of things. And, some people seem to handle it very well, or just didn't have those effects. Some of us, it seemed like everything was affecting us. And I was one of those guys, you know, I could not sleep when I worked night shift. I can't sleep during the day, and was eventually diagnosed with like 3 different sleeping disorders, disorders that I didn't have before I had this job. Ironically, I go to sleep faster now since being a cop than I ever did in private work. You know, I toss and churn for hours when I was in the music industry, and now I'm out when my head hits the pillow. And I think that I attribute that to just my sense of purpose. My body isn't wrestling, or my mind isn't wrestling with some of the, you know, feelings of not being in alignment. But anyway, I digress. But so I mean, sleep disorders, and then how do you, you know, prepare or meal prep or eat or all those things on night shift, and dealing with the stress, and, you know, everybody's home life is a little different. You know, do you have, what kind of support system you have? All those things contribute. I mean, I had kids early in my career. So I had newborns in the house for pretty much for the last, for the first 7 years of my career, I had, you know, young kids, very, very young kids in the house, which of course throws everything off. And my wife works, so that contributes to some of that too, and those challenges. It's like, it's cumulative, you know?
Yeah, no, it is. And it's that those layers that we're not taught. And I'm sure, you know, you started the podcast for that reason. I started the podcast for the same reason, is, you know, I came from a well-educated route. I've been a coach, you know, I've been an athlete my whole life. I've went to university and did exercise physiology. But even then, with all that, you know, supposed education, the Kurt Parsleys, the Eric Goodmans, you know, Lieutenant Dave Grossman, all these incredible people, I'm like, why haven't I heard of any of these people if I'm in this industry? This is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I heard some of those guys on yours, I heard someone on other podcasts, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to wrangle these people and get them to my audience as well, because first responders aren't just struggling to keep a little weight off because of, you know, the cake at the office, you know, or they're not struggling to put on a little bit extra weight. There are so many things that are against them, and the job is incredible, but there are areas that of shift work that we're not aware of that are setting us up for failure, not success.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not one single thing, and you don't realize it. And I didn't realize this when I started the show, and this is why I did start the squad room, was because, like you said, I was having these questions. I was asking them sort of open-ended sometimes in briefings. Others would come to me and had, they, you know, hey, I'm trying to figure this out too, or I have the same issue, or I'm like, well, if more people than just me have this question, there must be people all over the country and all over the world having these same issues, and why can't we figure this out? So yeah, that's exactly why I started it, was to figure this out for myself and then share that with people.
Yeah.
What I'm learning is it's all interrelated, right? I know you're big on sleep, right? And I know you've had Kirk Parsley on the show too, and he's been on mine as well. And learning from him about how much your sleep affects everything else, from heart disease to cancer to your temper and your mental state, all those things, and straight into your gut line too, right? Getting the sleep thing locked down is still a challenge to me, and I even know it's absolutely crucial, and I still have a hard time with it.
Yeah, well, I think that's the problem, especially in the fire service. You know, you guys have the challenge of the alternating shifts, you know, especially if you're doing the night and day, which, as he says, you know, are really, really bad. But then the 24-hour shifts, I don't think they're that bad in a fire station if you're given the time to recover. The problem is the Northeast is about the only area that truly has a handle on that, that does the 24/72s. Mm-hmm. The rest of the country is doing these crazy 56-hour, you know, whatever algorithm they use, it still ends up being 56, and they just do not have their time to recover. So you see them slowly, slowly chip away, and I've said this on mic before, I haven't met a firefighter yet with any amount of time on the job who's told me their testosterone is fine. They're all 300 or below, and that in itself is a huge, you know, warning sign that it's the environment, not the individual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I just anecdotally, I just came off of shift work and off patrol just 2 months ago, and I'm now at a desk job, and I'm already seeing some of those things balance out, you know, and without any noticeable change in anything else I'm trying. But it's just proof that, you know, the consistency of a being awake when normal people are awake and asleep when normal people are asleep, and having the ability to control your environment like that is such a huge factor. And when you're working a station or you're pushing a black and white, you have no say over that, right?
No, exactly. Now, what really struck me about the very, very first episode of your podcast, the intro, you tell a very, I mean, it's a courageous, vulnerable story about where you were at. And if you wouldn't mind kind of just giving us the cliff notes on that, but I think that's what needed to be said, is like, here's where I was at, and, you know, here's how I knew to find help. Because I tell you right now that so many people listening would be relieved, like, okay, I'm not the only person that feels like this.
Yeah, so that story, I hemmed and hawed about it for a little while, but then realized, you know, I don't put myself off as the expert on my show. I'm the guinea pig, and I want to learn, like I said, I want to learn these things for myself and then also share those things. So I don't get up there and tell you what you need to do, at least in the fitness and health stuff. The leadership discussions we have, I probably take a more active role because I've got more experience with that. And as a sergeant for 6 years now and some other experiences I've had, I feel like that I can speak on. But on the health and fitness stuff, I am very much the patient. And on that first episode, I have my friend Traver Beaumont. Traver is a coach and just an all-around kind of badass. And I tell the story of kind of what caused me to start the show or realize that I need help. I need to figure this out. Was, you know, I was like, I was that cop that was tired all the time. I was out of shape. I looked like a sack in my uniform. I'm trying to recall the details of the story, but short version is, like, you know, I'm in uniform and I go to take a leak, use the restroom, excuse me. Number one, going potty. Just because of how uncomfortable I was and the belt was so tight on me and my pants were so tight and my vest was so tight and all these things, it's like, I don't know what it was doing, but it was kind of causing a lot of issues where, like, I just ended up peeing in my pants. And not like I had to go change and, like, you know, or finish the day or whatever. But, you know, it was just like, once everything was put back away, it was like running down my leg and it's like, God, you know, I'm sorry.
Just to let you know, you can say whatever you want. We got the little explicit thing on this. So,
it was one of those kind of wake up moments, and I put it in there. Yeah. Exactly what you say. Like, I know other guys are going through it. We all have struggles, even the super fit, you know, muscular, skinny guys with perfect cholesterol and good T, they've got struggles too. And if I am going to have any success in getting people to accept some of this advice that I'm trying to put out there, I got to be willing to be as open and honest and vulnerable as I can be. It's a good way. I tend to be kind of self-deprecating anyway, and it was a good way for me to make sure I keep my ego in check as I start this podcast, where basically I'm talking into a mic and I get to say whatever I want and it's my show. You know, it's like there's an ability to be very narcissistic about having a podcast. So why not start it off with an incredibly embarrassing story that'll keep me grounded?
Yeah, that was, and it's very true. And you can easily find yourself, like you said, making the podcast about you and monologuing for hours. And, you know, I've heard some podcasters, they invite these guests on and they just walk all over them, you know, with their questions and their responses. And I try, you know, I wouldn't say mine's the patient. It's more, I went through a life of training on how to be fit and then found out that most of it was shit. So it's, yeah, trying to reverse engineer a lot of this miseducation that we've been taught. And that's kind of the angle I take it. But again, yeah, it's, you know, the moment you think that this is your show and you're the expert, you're basically throwing in the face of all these guests that you've had on that have educated you in the first place and given you this information.
Yeah. And like I said, like, we're all experts in different things. You know, I mean, there's things in the fire service you could talk ad nauseum about for hours. And like I said, I can talk as a patrol supervisor with a master's in leadership. I could talk about leadership for a long time and what I think about it, my opinions about it, my experiences with it in the field. But there are other things where I need to know that I'm not the go-to on this one. and there's plenty of those. And let me emphasize something too for listeners too. Like, I've been doing this show for a while now, almost 3.5 years. And there are, in some ways, I am no better off than I was, right? I have not found the magic pill, the magic solution, the perfect thing. And I still struggle with almost all of these things, you know, eating on duty. How do you do that? Maintaining weight, you know, dealing with the mental health issues of it. Like, I'm still navigating all that. It's not like I solved this and then went, aha, I figured it out and then put out a podcast. It's very much a journey.
Yeah. And I'm sure you find the same. And then just when you think, okay, on this area, I think I have got a handle of it, someone else comes on the show, you're like, oh shit, now I got to rethink the whole thing again.
Yeah, absolutely. Every episode's a learning experience and pushes you to consider what you're doing.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, speaking of one of your, you know, positive experiences, and I'm sure you consider it almost like a mentor, Traver and CrossFit. So how did you find yourself in the CrossFit space?
So in 2011, we just passed the anniversary of it, actually. 2011, I had a bike accident. I was, like I said, I was at one point a cyclist, and then I was an avid mountain biker. And I had a mountain biking accident where like a full search and rescue call out had to come pluck me off a mountain a couple miles up. And I had a compression fracture in my back, separated shoulder, fractured teeth, a lot of tendons torn in my neck. I was pretty messed up. In fact, it shattered my helmet in three different places. And I'm convinced that if I had landed just a couple of, an inch or two in any other direction, I probably would have snapped my neck because of the way that I ended up landing. So anyway, I was recovering from this back injury, and a coworker of mine, a guy who was actually my field training officer when I had started, was into CrossFit, and he showed me some of the videos that they had on YouTube and some videos of Greg Amundsen, who at this point has become a friend and mentor as well. And was just like, it made sense to me, and it looked interesting. And I talked to some people who were, you know, avid CrossFitters, because it doesn't take a CrossFitter much for them to talk about CrossFit.
Absolutely not.
What's the saying? The first rule of CrossFit is you never stop talking about CrossFit or something like that.
Yeah, it's the opposite of Fight Club.
Right. So I went in and tried it out. I went to a gym that I kind of looked at a couple around town, and I chose one that emphasized mobility and form. So there were some in town that emphasized like getting you ready for the games. The games weren't quite this big at the time, but you're like, you know, they kind of wanted to, like, if they left you in a puddle of your own puke at the end of a workout, they called that effective. I didn't want that because I didn't want to get hurt again, and I was being very ginger about my back. I wanted a place that function that was on form and function and mobility. And at the time, actually, my gym, Eric Goodman was teaching at my gym. He was doing foundation training, teaching at the gym. So that partnership really drew me there. And we would do foundations in warmups every day, and, you know, which is all back, and I have a back injury. So that's how I got into the gym. Traver is a guy who, he was the owner of the gym, or a co-owner of the gym. And just, he's one of those guys, like, from the minute I met him, was like, this guy's on fire. And there's something about him that just kind of draws you in, and you want to be in that orbit. And luckily I got to know him and become very good friends with him. And he's been on the show quite a bit. And he's lived a life that I can't even wrap my head around at this point.
And what was your very first CrossFit workout? Do you remember?
I don't remember, you know, usually people do, but it was like an intro, kind of a baseline. They called it the baseline, I think. And it was pretty basic body weight movement stuff. I think it was a run, push-ups, sit-ups, that sort of thing. I remember being absolutely horrible. And like a lot of people testify to, like, it was horrible. I was brutalized. My ego got kicked around, and I couldn't get enough.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? It's that humility that drives you back.
For me, what kept me there was, and it took me a while to realize this, but, you know, there's a lot of things you can knock about CrossFit, but if you have a gym that it really focuses on form and function and mobility, I think there's nothing better, at least for me. But the group aspect of it, you know, it was like going back to the academy and working out with a group, and everyone's cheering each other on, and everyone's there to better themselves. And it's a little competitive, but it's not like anyone's walking out of there with a belt or a prize money. It was just, you know, kind of bragging rights. And my experience in the academy every day during PT or any other practical in the academy was the same way. And so it was familiar in that way. And I really missed that.
Yeah. Yeah. I started doing CrossFit back in 07, but it was always either at a fire station or then in the YMCA on my own. And I've told the story many times, but early on, people laughed. As it got cooler, they asked my advice, which is a very interesting thing to see. But it was only 4 years ago now, I think, where I actually went to a CrossFit gym, and I ended up becoming a coach for that gym too. But I finally got it, the, like you said, the community side. And that just added like a whole different level, you know. And when you come from one family, whether it's, you know, police or fire, whatever it is, and you go to that other space, I think it's just such a healthy and nurturing environment to add to what we already have in our community.
Yeah, absolutely. And I went the opposite way. I started a gym. Traver and his partner eventually sold that gym, and I kind of left the gym. And I do the same sort of stuff, but I do it on my own. And I miss that, where you're sucking wind. You've got a couple more reps left, and everyone's, because I was never the guy that finished first. I might have been the guy that lifted the most weight on something, but I certainly wasn't the fastest at anything. And so I was used to having the people around me. They're all done and I'm there sucking wind, trying to get a couple more reps out. They're cheering you on and pushing you, and it just feels good, you know?
Yeah. Now, what did you think about the application then to your job? So finding this different kind of form of exercise, did you notice it in a big way on the police force itself?
That was immediately apparent. How the different types of movement, the different durations, and then how any of those movements applied. And, you know, I've had experiences where I would do something in the field and it was just like what we did in the workout a week before, you know, whether it was having to hold an AR-15 rifle over the hood of a car for an hour and a half during a bank robbery, or laying prone, or, you know, or grabbing gear and having to hike it up some stairs, you know, grabbing a bag of ammo and magazines or your kit, whatever it is, and running. Like, those things were directly related to the work. You know, even once had to help get one of our canines up and over a fence, and it was like doing a wall ball, a very squirrely, furry wall ball. And so that it didn't take any convincing to me that was the most applicable thing for my job.
Yeah. And then another area that I personally find, and I think that, you know, this is a kind of universal thing amongst first responders that do high intensity work like this, is it's the mental thing too, because you know, like you said, the calls you're talking about are some of the ones that you can pick out from weeks and weeks and weeks with probably not a huge amount going on. Whereas every time you go to the gym and you push yourself in that red zone, you know, in a sensible rotation, but you're constantly pushing out the boundaries of your mental resiliency as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That was the thing I never expected about CrossFit, because I'd done all just kind of standard gym workouts, you know, buys and tries and legs and whatever. And you don't get any of that from that kind of a workout. The resilience and the push yourself and stay through and push through it is huge. And oftentimes I've heard, you know, Greg Amundsen's been on my show, like I said, and he's got a saying that the biggest adaptation is between your ears. And that's absolutely appropriate. Even this morning, my workout this morning sucked. I made it up and it hurt and I wanted to quit like within minutes. But I knew that if I stuck through it, A, I was going to get the benefit of it that I intended for the day, but also that I was going to be proud of that fact and push through it. And it just got in my head as I started thinking about, here I am at like 94% max heart rate and I'm hurting and I can't get a breath, but I have the opportunity to breathe. You know, I'm here. And just the fact that it's a gorgeous day and I'm having a hard time breathing and I'm choosing that was like a gift. It was a gift to me that I was able to do this. And there are firefighters and law enforcement officers who no longer have that gift, who no longer have that ability to do that because of the things the job has done to them or that people on the job have taken away from them. And who am I to quit and not take full advantage of that?
Absolutely. Well, speaking of that, just to shift to the actual, you know, operational training, you had Tim Kennedy on as well, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had Tim on a couple of times. I actually was lucky enough to train with him. I trained with him in Austin just at a gym, but then he came here to my town, which is amazing. It's a small town in the middle of Florida, but they did the sheepdog response class here.
Yeah.
But what was crazy was it was right after the shooting we had in South Florida, the school shooting. And mm-hmm. So the guys that they work with, the sponsors, actually put together a whole load of scholarships for PD and first responders. And me and a couple other guys like worked really, really hard to advertise and promote and speak to all these agencies that we had around, and they still couldn't fill the classes. The civilian class was full, but the one for law enforcement wasn't. And it blew me away and it was embarrassing. And I know they had a similar experience in another place recently, and they were like, okay, we're done with that part of the country for now, because everything was put on a plate and they still couldn't, you know, basically for free get these people to go through. So what's your observation, because that's obviously not my agency, it's law enforcement, what's your observation on the training that's given in most of the departments and the interest in raising your game as far as bringing other people in.
Yeah, it's sadly that's not surprising to me at all. I don't think this is about the kind of people we are. It's more the what happens to us. And one of my favorite books is Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement by Dr. Kevin Gilmartin. And he talks about the Eustas and how you used to be a hiker. You used to go dancing. You used to do all these things. But as we get older, as our responsibilities increase, with kids, as the job starts to wear and tear on us, our Eustas start to eliminate. And now all we do is sit in a chair and drink a scotch or whatever. And it's really hard at some point for a lot of people to kind of get out of that chair, step out of their comfort zone and try something new. And, I think a lot of us, it's just a character trait of time on. I think that you really have to work at keeping yourself open-minded to new experiences, because new experiences have the potential to expose you to things that are uncomfortable, that bring up, issues for you. And a lot of guys just don't want to deal with it. They bury it. And one way to bury it is to just not go. And they just, they'll go with what they know. And the misery of the present is better than the possible change. Does that that makes sense?
Yeah, no, it does. I saw it with that. And I think there's a lot of fear too. I think people, a lot of people know that they've let it slip and then they're embarrassed to, or they're scared to embarrass themselves, when the reality should be there's no better place for me to humiliate myself or feel like I'm humiliating myself than in a nice, safe training environment in a police gym or a shooting range where no one's going to die.
Right. Yeah, Tim said something on my show that has stuck with me, which I used to record in my garage. Moved up to the house now with my wife's permission, but I used to record in the garage. And behind me was my backdrop was the squat rack I have and an American flag and stuff like that. But as Tim's talking to me, I don't even realize that he sees these things. And he says, he's like, I see you. I see the kind of guy who you've got a squat rack behind you. You're obviously someone who's trying to make things better. You're trying to improve your situation. He's like, and I will double down on you any day of the week. The people he doesn't want to waste time on are the ones who aren't willing to do anything for themselves. You got to do something. No one's coming for you, And I think any of us who've been in this job for any amount of time know, if I left tomorrow, if I got hurt and I medically retired tomorrow, there would be someone to replace me by the end of the week. And it wouldn't be long before it was Garrett who, and because that's the nature of the job. None of us is that crucial that we aren't replaceable immediately. And so they're not going to do it for us. We need to do it for ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. Now shifting the focus from us, because your show, and I think my show as well, align in this way where it's about ownership of the individual, the firefighter, the medic, the police officer, the ER nurse, whoever's listening. But then also looking at the shifts and the organization. And another place that I've kind of found very, very little activity at all is what people self-describe as leadership, more bugles, whatever. But I brought some things to this town, whether it's sheepdog response or some mental health stuff I just did recently, and it's been tumbleweeds. So what do you think are some of the issues, and it doesn't have to be about your own department, but in general that you see that causes apathy within the higher ranks too?
I think in general, our higher ranks, and I'm not speaking specifically about my department, just in general from talking to people, is they're occupied by old school, and they're occupied by the guys who grew up in the, suck it up era. And they don't understand these things. Never mind that they're heavy, they may be heavy drinkers with a 55-inch waistline and three divorces and high blood pressure, and you think, gee, I wonder why, but they still have this suck it up mentality. Luckily that's changing as the new generation comes into leadership, and you have some very progressive people in positions like Steve, I've drawn a blank on his last name now, But like in Reno PD and some of the work they've done with both their fire and law personnel, where the city council actually got very involved. And you've got, you know, San Diego is another great example of an area where they're really emphasizing these things. It's getting better. And the 21st century policing report that came out during Obama was pretty critical of policing, but they did not acknowledge that mental health was absolutely critical to moving forward. And that that actually provoked a lot of discussion with a lot of departments when it came from the president's office, who was not, you know, not particularly prone to support law enforcement, but still said, this is important. Mental health is important. It has to be considered. A lot of people started looking at that and thinking, okay, well, what do we do? And so I think it's changing, but it really takes courage. It takes time. I think in my experience, people want to do the right thing. They want to do good by their people, but it's just another thing on the checklist of things to do, you know?
Yeah.
And unless you make it, it's like I tell my kids sometimes, or maybe some people that I work with, you know, if something doesn't get done, be honest and just say it wasn't a priority. You know, don't make excuses. If I didn't work out this morning, I could have said, well, I had an interview coming up and I had to get the house straightened up and my wife had some things I needed to take care of. But in reality, it's like, no, it's just working out wasn't a priority. And that requires self-reflection and honesty and self-awareness to be able to say, yeah, it's just not a priority for me that my officers have mental health services, for example.
Yeah.
And that's a hard thing to admit. And that's not something people will admit, of course, you know. And so, but I think we're moving the ball forward. And honestly, I think shows like this, like yours and mine, we push that discussion forward. I know that chiefs and sheriffs listen to my show and get ideas out of it. That's, to me, mind-blowing that I might have some effect, positive effect on deputies or officers on the other side of the country or even on the other side of the world. And it's just because they're listening to the show and the people I have on, and they're connecting the dots on their own, but it's helping. And when I get those kinds of emails, man, I'm sure you get them too. It's like, there's no better motivation for me than knowing that this is going out and helping people.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, speaking of a mutual guest that we've had now, and I heard him on your show first, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, what are your department or your area, what are some of the things that you guys have changed with regard to dealing with, you know, mass shootings and that kind of thing? Because I've heard some, you know, conflicting stuff, and I had some great guests talk about this, but the way that we've been taught in my agencies where I've worked recently, the SAVE training is the closest thing. And even though it's a good system for a specific type of building, it's very limited and doesn't focus on the bigger picture. So having, you know, you being someone who's had some of these great guests and is also involved in leadership in law enforcement, what are some of the models you found that are most appropriate now in 2018?
In terms of how we respond tactically to a mass shooting?
Yes.
So we've had the unfortunate distinction of having a few, and they've spanned a couple of years. We've been fortunate that none of them have been a school shooting, but we had one in 2014 where a madman drove around in his car executing sorority girls and random people on the street. I guess it's pretty open ended in terms, because that was him driving around a 1 square mile radius neighborhood near a campus. But in terms of school shootings, we're trying to get better and better on working directly with the fire department in moving from strictly hot and cold zones to getting them comfortable working in a warm zone. And for people who may not, I don't know if that you're familiar with these terms. But a hot zone is what it sounds like. You're in the fire, or you're not in the fire. You're in the line of fire. A firefight is going on. There's an active, immediate threat to life. That would you consider the hot zone. Warm zone is you may be near this area, but you're not directly taking fire or not directly in the line of fire. You may be around a corner or in a different building, but you're still not somewhere where you're safe. And then cold zone would be removed from the area and staging, basically. And you know, the practice in the past has been that we go in, try and address the threat and secure it and basically make it either a warm or cold zone before fire and medical personnel come into the scene to start extracting victims. And we're moving more towards these rescue task force teams that move with fire personnel, gets assigned some officers, and they move together it kind of behind, trying to the best way to describe it, but you know, there's the initial approach of officers who go in to try and address the threat, but shortly behind them are officers and fire and medic personnel going in to triage and treat victims and get them out of there and move and work in that warm zone. And so we're doing that. I don't know how it is in your area. I'd be curious to hear, especially after some of the stuff you've guys have dealt with and if that's changing at all.
Yeah, I think, you know, Florida's a big state. So there are some that are very progressive. There's some that are literally sticking their head in the sand. It'll never happen. But it seems like you're talking about, we went so far the extreme from probably how it used to be, where everyone just ran towards the gunfire back in the olden days. And then, you know, it went uber health and safety to Columbine's a perfect example. These people are bleeding to death and everyone's staging, to trying to find that middle ground. But it seems like the tactical medic type model, where you've got men and women that are actually trained to be in that warm zone, like you said, not out there kicking doors in and being the entry team, but volunteering and saying, yes, I don't mind being in this slightly more dangerous area because I signed up to be a firefighter, it's dangerous as well. But understanding that if you just want to be part of a team that stages at the station till, you know, the media are packing up, then people are going to die. And I think that being more aggressive in this kind of situation is the only way we can truly mitigate these disasters.
Yeah, it takes, and you know, it's the kind of thing, it's so complicated, the response. And I actually just went through a 3-day active shooter management course in terms of, like, you know, you're the first supervisor on scene, how do you start this? And one of the things we need to work on the law side is ICS and using incident command system for our response to stuff. And one of the things I'm very jealous about fire, excuse me, is their ability to implement an ICS system immediately. And how, you know, we're unfortunate in the sense that we have plenty of wildfires in the area, which we just had recently. And we'll have fire teams, fire department teams come from Arizona and Washington, even Texas and Utah. But regardless of what state they're in, they can plug and play in this ICS system. And we don't use that in law, and we need to get better about that. So we're trying to learn ICS. And then so we can kind of have the same language as fire, but then teaching our personnel too, that it doesn't benefit you to just drive straight into the scene, grab your AR and run inside. Like, we need an organized approach. And that requires a lot of discipline and rehearsal, which is, of course, something itself that we don't always, you know, costs money and time. And so we don't practice nearly as much as we should. So that's why we do a lot of these mental rehearsals and briefing as well.
Yeah. And the problem is that money and time should be available. And that's something I've discussed a lot on this, is educating the public too. And, you know, you can front load your budget to these departments and allow them to train to be the best prepared, or you can wait for a disaster, cry, you know, have news articles on how tragic it was, and then wait for people to throw money after everyone's dead. And that's the problem, is that there's a lot of myopic, you know, politics when it comes to first responders. And 9/11 is a perfect example. 9/10, everyone was fighting for budgets. 9/11, they were drowning in money. Where did that come from if it wasn't there before?
Yeah, one of the biggest misconceptions I've heard from the public is, you know, they think that we have the funding and the training of like SEAL Team 6, you know, where we're always shooting rounds and we're always practicing our jujitsu or our arrest and control tactics, or we're always rehearsing these things and we've got shoot houses. And it's like, man, that can't be further than the truth from 99% of the agencies out there. You know, we all struggle with budget constraints, with time constraints. Nowadays, we don't even have the staffing to let people off to go do those kinds of trainings often, you know, on their own time or on their own dime. You know, we can't afford the staffing issue. So it's a big misnomer to think that it's just a matter of, you know, want or need. We don't get that kind of funding.
No. Now you hear of some of these agencies that literally are given the ammunition for the weapon they carry on their belt, and then whatever they need to qualify once, twice a year at a range. Now that's insanity to me, and I point this out. What kind of officer do you want pulling over your nervous teenage son that's just, you know, going through his glove box to find his driving license? Do you want the jittery, sleep-deprived cop that has barely used his weapon in months? Or do you want the well-rested, well-trained cop that will remain calm, you know, identify there's a difference and act appropriately?
Yeah, and I've never heard anybody choose the stressed out, poorly trained, bad tactics cop for that stop, right? That's absolutely right.
Yeah, yeah. All right, well, kind of on the same theme, I'm asking you this question. I'm not well educated, but from my perspective, it seems like line of duty death, especially in the law enforcement community, as far as officer involved shootings, you know, the officers getting killed, appears to be just as high as it's ever been. Is that skewed because of the media, or is it getting worse at the moment?
Well, it seems to be pretty consistent year to year, with give or take a few in terms of how many. The one that scares me is that is this death by suicides, you know, and how that's it, depending on how you track that, that is 4 to 6 times greater than the line of duty deaths, because you know they only track not every department reports the suicides. And they only track active duty. So if you consider retired cops too, that it just spikes. Obviously, I think overall over the last 20, 25 years, we've gotten less line of duty deaths in general. They are certainly more publicized, but I also think they're much more violent in general. You think of Dallas, you know, the shootout with 4 Dallas officers killed. That's a more violent shootout than you would have seen in, 20, 30 years ago, maybe. We had one just recently here in my neighboring county with a borderline mass shooting where a guy took out 12, killed 12 people, and the first guy in the door was a sergeant from Ventura County Sheriff's Office. And, he was killed confronting the gunman. And so they're higher profile for sure. But I don't know if I can be, I don't know if I'm the best to give you a stat from DOJ on line of duty deaths this year versus last year versus 20 years, but they seem to be about the same. The other challenge is a lot of our deaths come from traffic accidents, and about half of our deaths every year come from traffic accidents. And as a sergeant, I'm always on my guys about seatbelts, and, you know, we don't need to run code to every call, and we don't certainly need to run, you know, code 3 for us is lights and sirens, and we joke that there's code 2.5, which is drive the same way, just not without lights and siren. But not everything is a code 3 run. And I can't imagine losing a guy in any scenario, but in one in which it was completely preventable by our own actions, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I want to get to the suicide in a second as well, because that's obviously a very important topic, but again, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman had a good point about the fatalities, because the numbers are staying the same, but technology is advancing greatly, and you've got vests and you've got trauma surgery and tourniquets. So those numbers are skewed too, because, you know, if you didn't have all that stuff, the numbers would probably still be a lot higher.
Yeah, it's absolutely right. Our technology and our equipment has saved us countless times.
Yeah. All right. Well, with the mental health, from your perspective, as you know, as an officer, as a leader, as you know, a host of a podcast where you're getting these great minds on, what are some of the things that you're attributing to this increase in suicide in PD?
You know, I think, again, I don't think it's necessarily an increase as much as it may be just we're more aware of it. You know, suicide was certainly not something that was talked about openly, even just 10 years ago. And I think a lot of deaths, quote unquote, back in the day were probably swept under the rug in terms of how it occurred. But also I think we've lost some of our ability to be resilient. just thinking about past generations and what they've had to deal with, perhaps we have not had to be quite so, we haven't been quite so challenged. You know, I just, we're recording on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. And so thinking about what that generation went through today and what that meant for them, you know, that they were entering a world war, that's different than what a lot of our collective experience is now. And I don't know if that's part of it. I don't know if it's just that we are more aware of these things. We've lost some, maybe we've lost some of that. I don't know. That's part of the journey to try and figure this out.
Yeah, because I mean, I think that's definitely an element. I think that we also get fed, our generation was fed a completely ridiculous image of what a man is. The Rambo, Terminator, John Wayne bullshit. Never cries and, you know, can shoot 1,000 Vietnamese with a pistol. But
yeah, let me clarify too. I agree. I don't, when I say resilient and I'm, you know, talking about World War II, like it's not that, it's not the macho, you know, suck it up. Like I talked about earlier, that's not what it is. It was just, I don't know if we don't have the skills anymore or if we have gone the other way. I don't know. But yeah, you're absolutely right. That being the macho, never cry, Rambo guy, that's not been a success for anybody.
No. And I wonder if that stopped people from reaching out in our generation, because you don't hear of a great suicide epidemic post World War II. And I point this out a lot, but you watch Band of Brothers, the most courageous men, some of those real men that talk at the beginning of the end of each episode, are still in tears 70 years after the event, because real men do cry. These are the most heroic soldiers, or some of the most heroic soldiers that ever, you know, set foot on this planet, and they're in tears because of course you're going to be moved by all the atrocities that you've seen.
Yeah, anybody who's done either of our jobs, fire, law, or, you know, medics, and then you can expand that into, you know, emergency room personnel, like you're different. You have changed in tangible ways, and it's up to you whether you accept that or not. And then understand what it is doing to you or could do to you, and how you need to, it's complete. Some of these changes are completely manageable and you can use them quote unquote for good, but you're not going to prevent the changes from happening. You know?
Yeah.
I will never be the guy that has not had 13 years of law experiences come at me. I will never be able to shun any of that. How I manage it, how I use it, how I educate myself from that, and how I'm self-aware of that, that's up to me on how to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the other, again, that's ownership. And then the other side is I honestly think that the shifts and the sleep deprivation are a huge cause of that as well. You know, and then the lack of tribe too is another thing. As we start diving into our cell phones more and talking and having human connection less, all those things create the perfect storm for exposing any cracks that people might have.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's on us as the newest generation of leaders. It's on the people who listen to our shows, who are wanting to carry this torch, to get into positions where they can affect that change and make changes to the shift work and the working conditions as best we can.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I want to shift slightly to a TED Talk, and we talked right before we started recording. I just saw this morning, and I was uber impressed by the delivery, by the content as well. But firstly, what made you decide to do this TED Talk? And then secondly, if you wouldn't mind, you know, telling us the content of it.
Sure. So I've always been a fan of TED Talks. I love them. I've always watched them. And it's always been kind of in the back of my mind that'd be fun to do one. In January of this year, 2018, we had a major mudslide, we call it a debris flow, in our area, which was in my jurisdiction, and overnight, and it killed 23 people and wiped out entire neighborhoods, and really was a huge, huge moment in the career of anyone who was working for us at the time. And I have friends who were experienced in that. In the talk, I even talk about the doctor who did my hand surgery. He died with his daughter in the slide. Friends lost homes. And one of those friends who was in that evacuation area, didn't lose her home, but in the evacuation area, is the executive producer of TEDx Santa Barbara, and has been always very supportive of what I'm trying to do here with the podcast and supportive of law enforcement in general. And she called me up and asked me to speak on my experience. Actually, she said I could talk about anything. She said I didn't have to talk about the slide. She basically gave me a carte blanche to talk about anything that I thought the public should know about something about law enforcement. And it was a great opportunity to kind of bridge that connection with people and talk on something that I thought was important. And I struggled for a long time about what to talk about, because I can talk to cops or any first responder for hours on end about most any topic. Proof here that I can talk and ramble ad nauseum. But that's my audience. That's my people. But I'm not used to, I am always uncomfortable around quote unquote, I don't want to say civilians, citizens, other citizens about police work. Cause you never know their attitudes towards the cops or what they think. You also don't want to come off as aggressive or cynical or any of those things as well. So I wasn't sure what to talk about. And then I started thinking about the slide, my experience during that, and ended up writing the speech in one sitting. In fact, I wrote the entire speech was in one sitting, and then it was just a few edits from there. And then I'm one to think that, okay, if that just flowed out of me in 3 hours of not getting up from my chair and just constantly in writing stream of consciousness for 3 hours, that's probably a clue. So it talks, my talk is about the importance of second responders. You know, we're all first responders. We all know what that is. But in this experience of this debris flow, the second responders were normal citizens who stepped up to help people in the recovery. And that was everything from people who organized clothing donations to people who, groups that organized and literally went out and helped people dig out their homes with a Home Depot bucket and a shovel. And they would just show up and ask if people needed help, because this slide for the homes that it didn't take out, this slide would bury homes up through the first story with this mud. And it required extreme effort to get it out. And so hundreds of these volunteers were showing up and helping people dig out of their homes. And it was so the talk is about my experience kind of watching these things and realizing that everybody's a hero. And I really do believe that everybody's got the opportunity to be a hero. My experience coming into law enforcement, I didn't think I had what it takes to be a cop, but I had to try. And then 13 years later, I'm convinced, you know, I can do anything this job requires. And it's not because I'm a badass. It's because I just stepped up. I learned it and I wanted to be a cop. But people can be heroes in any different way. You know, I tell a story in the talk about a little girl who's raising, runs a lemonade stand to raise money for injured vets. And and she's a hero as much as I am. And people who, devote time and attention to homeless issues or whatever issue it is, to veterans or veteran suicide or, battered women or all these things. Like there's so many examples of people out there. And this is one of the things I saw that came out of 9/11 too, was how people just stepped up and helped. And any major incident I've been involved in, and I've been involved in a ton of wildfire responses, mass shooting responses, and always, always people want to help and they step up. And so I didn't coin the term second responders, but the talk is about these people that step up. And how you can do that and how you can be that person in your community and how you can help people. Because, again, no one else is coming to save us. We got to do it ourselves. But if we each do it, we can raise our collective effort and really be there for each other.
Yeah, and I think that's a philosophy that's kind of lost a little bit. And I've talked on this before as well. But it almost seems like, when you're talking about your country, everyone's looking up to that big White House in Washington and, you know, either happy or disappointed when someone gets elected or doesn't get elected, and totally miss the point of just walking out your front door and helping the people in your community. And if everyone does that, you force the change. And so regardless of who's sitting in that building, if we collectively want to, fund the police properly, in improve kindness, you know, whatever it is, if enough of us shake the tree, it's going to happen. But we seem to have that pyramid upside down for some reason.
Yeah, absolutely. I give the example in the talk of you know, if you coach your kids' little league team or softball team or soccer team or whatever, think of that as your opportunity to be a hero. And you have the opportunity to lead these young boys or girls and show them and demonstrate to them what it means to be a good citizen, a good father, a good man, a good woman, a good mother, any of those things, the roles that you play. You have the opportunity to portray that for them and give them an example of it. And that is heroic, you know, because you're doing what you can in the context of what you're capable of. And that'll change throughout your life. It'll change day to day, even throughout the day. But if people can go out and do what they can, then we really have an opportunity to be a nation of heroes.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And like I said, I'd highly advise everyone to look up the TED Talk and listen, because you tell that story so well. And it's a 12-minute talk and hits the nail on the head, in my opinion.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
All right. So one more thing I want to talk about before we transition to some closing questions is this, again, the image of the police officer that's being portrayed at the moment. I've had some great people. One of them was Craig Hanami, who kind of went viral as the skateboarding police officer. So, you know, obviously I know as a firefighter, you guys do an incredible job. We all see the one who's a douchebag as well as we see the firefighter who's a douchebag, but that's the minority. But again, for some reason, we seem to be stuck in this ugly, vicious cycle where the images that are being spat out regarding law enforcement are usually that 1% that's wrong, or, you know, the questionable one where you know as a first responder you're like, well, no, that police officer wasn't in the wrong, but you don't understand what it's like being a police officer, so to you it looks like it was wrong. But I'm kind of spinning around a little bit. What is from inside law enforcement, do you feel like you're in a dark place as far as public perception? And if so, how do we change that?
So I'm a bit counter to some of this, and I think that I disagree with the idea that we are in a dark place. I think that we have a lot of attention on us, but rightfully so. I think that, yes, there absolutely are times where we are misrepresented, where there might be media that have an agenda that is it's productive for them to flame us like that, but we have to expect it. You know, I use this idea on the show a lot, and I have an episode about it, but I call it Fighting in the Shade. And it's a story from the Battle of 300, right? The Battle of Thermopylae, when a warrior goes to Leonidas and is basically complaining because the Persians have so many arrows so many archers that when they shoot their arrows, it will darken the skies and it will blot out the sun. And Leonidas replies, well, good, then we shall fight in the shade. And to me, that is a direct application to the work we do, because we have to expect the arrows are going to be slung and it shouldn't be a shock. We have an obligation and a responsibility, given the power we have, to understand that this is part of the process. And to me, that Monday morning quarterbacking of us not only is expected, but it's almost an obligation of the press, because it does keep us in check. Now, I don't like it, and I don't enjoy listening to them lambast an officer when I can see he did things right, but we have to understand that it plays a role. And all of this bickering and whining about how the media doesn't treat us fairly I have yet to find a cop whose career or life or psychology or family life has gotten better by all the time they spend complaining about the media. So we have to expect that it's coming. We have to be able to fight in that shade of those arrows. The flip side of that is that it's incumbent on each of us who is a good cop to do everything we can in every contact we have with the community to, again, demonstrate what it means to be a professional police officer, but also take the opportunity to tell our personal stories when appropriate to, so that people understand that we aren't RoboCops. We are people. We have ideas, beliefs, emotions, and we are, like I said, only people, and that we're in this with them. We sometimes forget that that thin blue line doesn't mean it's that that thin blue line isn't us versus them, right? It's the, that that idea of the thin blue line is we are on that line preventing the chaos and the violence from overcoming us and reaching the general public. And a lot of people misrepresent the thin blue line as us versus them, and that's not it at all. And if you have an us versus them attitude, good luck. If you have the opportunity to tell your story, like, it's, and it's tiresome, and it takes discipline to be able to be willing when people ask you things that are annoying to talk to them about it. You know, I mean, any cop has been asked, do you ever shoot anybody? You know, and not having a quip answer back, but having an honest answer back, whether you have or haven't. But I've seen people ask that question. And I've luckily been in a situation where I've never had to shoot someone, but others, plenty of my neighbor, my partners have. And it changes the temperature in the room when they get an honest reply and they talk about how they, what it did to them as a person, right? So we tell those stories and we connect with people closer. I think things are improving, actually. People are seeing things like what happened 2 weeks ago in Ventura when the sheriff sergeant ran into the fire gunfire to confront the shooter and ended up dying. Those things are getting as much attention, if not more, than the negative stuff.
Yeah, well, that's good to hear. And that's a great way of putting it as well. Because, I mean, like you said, there's that accountability. But also, you know, when they're throwing that that way, that gives you an opportunity to actually tell the whole story. But, you know, it just breaks my heart because, you know, like you said, with the Ventura one, you see the sacrifice that the men and women make. And so when it's turned to a negative side, unless it's justified, I still, you know, it angers me because the people behind those typewriters metaphorically have probably never put themselves in danger before. And there are certain incidents where, yes, clearly, yeah, that officer was out of line, and, you know, whether it's a murder charge or whatever it is, but you know, like you said, there are so many people, and in my opinion, almost, I think it's almost more pressure to go running in because you hear of things like the Pulse shooting, and, you know, the lack of training, and you wonder now if some of these people are being pushed into incidents unnecessarily where maybe if they'd been able to wait for backup, they may not have been killed. So there's that unseen pressure from the other side as well. As courageous as they may be to maybe, as we mentioned earlier, pick up an AK and run towards the gunfire, that may be not the best strategic action despite, you know, the fear of losing life.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, one of the things I always think about and I try to tell my guys, like, I can't expect some journalist to know what it's like to do my job, you know, and you see this sometimes where they do these things where they'll take them out and they'll do a simulated use of force and the reporter will report back like, gosh, geez, it really is actually really hard to make a decision in 1.5 seconds, whether you shoot this guy or not. And those are enlightening and they're good. But in general, like, I can't, like, my own wife doesn't really understand the job. Right. And she's around it. And her dad was a cop, and like, she knows that job better than most, but even she doesn't understand it. I, for example, I can't imagine what it's like to be a cop in Chicago, right? I do the same job. I wear a gun, a badge, a belt, all the same things. You put me next to a Chicago cop, you know, like in a lineup, we look the same. But I can't imagine that environment of policing in Chicago or Baltimore, any of those environments, because the job to me is so different there than it is for me, right? There's always these degrees of severity. So here I am in Southern California, and I have a hard time wrapping my head around what it's like to be a cop in Chicago. That's my dog, sorry.
No problem.
So I have no idea what it's like to be a cop in Chicago. If I, who already have all the skills, knowledge, training, and abilities of being a cop don't know what that's like. How can I expect some journalist to know that? So I think that has a perspective for it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, I'd love to transition to some closing questions. The first one I like to ask, is there a book that you love to recommend to people? It can be about what we've discussed today or something completely different.
I'm a pretty avid reader. I always buy more books than I read, but you know, in the context of our conversations, there's a couple that are influential. I mentioned Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement. It's completely applicable to the fire service as well. Kevin Gilmartin, the author, he's a police psychologist. He was a Arizona officer for 30 years before he went into private practice. Very enlightening and a great, great in-person class as well. Another book that I think was influential to me was The Heart and the Fist by Eric Greitens, the now former governor of Missouri. But at the time, he was a Navy SEAL, Rhodes Scholar, and he writes about his humanitarian work. And to me, that book, though not about law enforcement, has a lot about the need for the heart and the fist in how we police.
Absolutely. Okay, so then the same question, but a movie and or a documentary?
You know, Netflix right now has Flint Town, which I think is very interesting and fascinating, and a very honest look at what a major city police department is struggling with everything that else is going on. I think that one's very good. I was having this discussion yesterday about just regular movies, about the best cop movie, because we heard someone else getting asked this, and I was talking with my partner, and I think we both agreed. You know, End of Watch is great. It's unrealistic in terms of the tactics and everything that are used, but it shows the partner relationship really well. There's other great movies, but we both thought The Other Guys was probably the funniest and best cop movie out there.
Yeah. Did you ever see the new Chips that they made?
Yeah. That was
pretty funny too.
It's funny. Oh,
yeah. And then Flint Town, that's Flint, Michigan, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So and then that's another agency that I'm assuming is probably struggling financially as well, seeing as it's such a poor town.
Yeah. There's another one on Netflix called, I think it's called the 7-6 or 7-5. It's about the New York NYPD precinct where they just had a ton of corruption in the 80s. And they actually have the guys who were doing the corruption on camera giving interviews, and they're completely honest about everything that went down. And it's interesting because you see guys who at least profess that they were good guys first, and then they got dirty because they got talked into it, and this downward spiral, how it went quick. But that's a pretty fascinating one too.
I'll have to watch that. You had a guy, was he LAPD? Remember there was yeah, a recording quality issue, but
yeah, Ruben Palomares. He was a LAPD, and he got taken down during the Rampart scandal.
That's right. Yeah, that was a really good episode. It's just a shame, you know, the quality. But I know myself, you know, the Skype and where they're talking from on their phone and what technology they're using can definitely, you know, you think it's a good one, and you go to do the editing, and you're like, oh shit, this sounds terrible.
Yeah. It was a struggle, but the stuff was good. I had to put it out.
Yeah, no, and that's the thing. It wasn't distracting. You still definitely hear him. All right. So the very last one before we talk about finding you, finding the podcast. What do you do to decompress?
I think the podcast is one of those ways. Just talking with people, understanding that these are issues that are universal, that helps. As much as I'm not an athlete, I do enjoy going to the gym. And I find that on days that I don't make it to the gym, I have a much harder day. So if I can get to the gym early in the day, I have a much more productive and better day. And I think that's completely proven, you know, in studies after study, that physical exertion like that just releases and off gasses a lot of those issues. I write for Police One, and write for my own stuff and working on different projects there. I find that kind of creative expression helpful. And I got two very young, very active kids, so I don't have too much time to sit around and mope. Gotta be paying attention to them as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You're juggling a lot there. All right, so then the very last thing, where can people find the podcast? Where can they find you online? And if they want to reach out to you?
So podcast is available on almost all the major players, you know, iTunes and Stitcher and all the others. This website is thesquadroom.net, and you can find a host of issues or all of the issues or issues, all of the episodes there, and some other information. Some information I always talk about being the one. That's a theme of the show. And there's some information on the site about how you can be the one. The TED Talk, of course, too. If they just search my name in TEDx Talk, it'll pop up. And then if people want to reach out, ask a question, always they can. I always encourage them to email me, Garrett, two R's, two T's, at thesquadroom.net. And I'm on Instagram and Twitter, at thesquadroom.
Brilliant. All right. Well, I want to say thank you so much. I will put all those links on the webpage for this episode. But it's been so bizarre to talk to you when, you know, before I was just a listener, and now getting to talk to you and pick your brains on the journey that you took through all the guests that you've had. But I really appreciate you taking the time and reaching out to my audience.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on, James. It's been a pleasure, and you're doing amazing work for the same community. So we need each other.